think that for poor Yugoslavia it is too late. I don't think that at this point there is a just solution. Now this country is dying and dying in blood and suffering. The old Cold War world is gone, but a new world is still in the making. So the sad lesson from the Yugoslav tragedy is that the world is different, and it has to figure out, to accomplish different rules.
Bulgarian scholar Ekaterina Nikova, with Robert Putnam of Harvard University and Irish statesman Conor Cruz O'Brien, she's here to talk about civil societies in the modern world. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Rockefeller Foundation, the John M. Olin Foundation, and the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, with assistance from the Inter-American Institute for Human Rights. As a concept, the idea of a civil society is as old as the Greeks. As a hope, it's as fresh as the most recent round of negotiations in the Middle East, Northern Ireland, or the former Yugoslavia. Over the last several years, in conferences and through the encouragement of individual scholarship, the National Humanities Center has explored the idea of a civil society, that malleable space between the power of government and the privacy of the individual. Listen now as three distinguished commentators reflect on various aspects of the idea of civil societies in the modern world. First, Robert Putnam of Harvard University talks about civic engagement in contemporary America. Following that, you'll hear from Irish statesman Conor Cruz O'Brien and from Bulgarian scholar Ekaterina Nikova. Robert Putnam directs the Center for International Affairs at Harvard University. In a recent piece that became required reading at the White House, he discussed America's traditions of independent social engagement. At once whimsical and serious, Putnam's comments were entitled "Bowling Alone: America's Declining Social Capital."
The proprietor of one of the nation's largest chains of bowling alleys came to me. He heard I was working on this subject, and he said, "Professor Putnam, you may not know it, but you've stumbled into one of our most important commercial problems. The problem is this: more people than ever before are bowling. Bowling is big in America. More Americans this year will bowl than will vote." Mm-hmm. And bowling is up by about 10% over the last 10 years or so. But bowling in leagues, bowling on teams, is down by about 40%.
Now, how in the world do you extrapolate an argument about civic engagement from a bowling metaphor?
Well, the evidence, of course, for declining civic engagement goes well beyond bowling, Wayne. There's over the last 20, 25 years, I would say it's been largely unnoticed, but a pretty substantial decline in all forms of civic engagement in the United States.
We're talking about voter registration and all of these voluntary kinds of elements.
That's right. PTAs and the Lions Club, what I've come to call the animal clubs, because I've discovered that men's organizations all, for some reason, are named for animals. The Lions Club and the Moose Club and the Elks Club and the Eagles Club and so on. All the animal clubs have had declining membership for the last 15 or 20 years. Women's clubs of various sorts declining. As I say, PTA membership is down. Volunteering for the Red Cross is off by about 50%. Volunteering for adult volunteers for Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and so on. So in many different ways, we've had a declining pattern of civic engagement for 15 or 20 years.
Now, we want to come to some reasons for all of this, Bob Putnam, but take me back to the 1830s, and we have a visitor from Europe who comes to the United States and says, "The strength of America is its voluntary spirit," or voluntarism.
Yes.
Fill that in for me.
Well, that's right. Alexis de Tocqueville was one of the greatest social analysts ever, and he was puzzled over the fact that the United States, this fledgling democracy over here in the New World, was able to sustain a democracy and was trying to figure out what's the secret ingredient. And the answer turned out to be all of this pattern, he said, of voluntary associations of all sorts, connections that people made in their local community. You didn't wait for an answer to come from the government. Mm-hmm. You got together with your neighbors and solved problems. That has been one of America's great strengths, and by comparison to many other countries in the world, it still is. We still have relatively high levels of voluntary spirit and engagement, civic engagement, by comparison to other countries in the world, mm-hmm. is still relatively high here. But compared to our own past, we've had a significant fall off in the last generation. That concerns me.
Are you looking for bad guys? Are you looking for villains
here
or what?
No, I'm certainly not looking for bad guys. I'm looking for what might be, or bad gals either. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that, that's a good place to begin, probably the single most important factor that explains this trend is the emergence of two career families. Mm-hmm. The fact that our mothers were not working outside the home, but they were very active in knitting communities together. They were in coffee clutches, or they were volunteering for the local women's club or whatever.
Now, this is an image that would make our feminist listeners bristle.
Well, I'm not absolutely sure you're right about that, you see, because what I'm doing is saying that the things that our mothers did, which weren't counted as part of the GNP, were socially productive, uh-huh. and it's really important to recognize and validate the things that they were doing. I'm not suggesting... I'm very proud of my daughter. My daughter is a young professional woman, and I wouldn't for a moment want her to quit her professional career. I think it is very important that we've opened up opportunities for women in the current generation. But mm-hmm. it does mean that as all of those women have gone off to work and are no longer involved as our mothers were in the creation of community, men haven't picked up the ball. So we've had over the course of the last generation, we've taken roughly a third of all the adults in America off one set of tasks, that is building community, mm-hmm. and we put them on the other set of tasks, and nobody's picked up the slack. And I want to emphasize that it's my concern about that is not just warm feelings, cuddly feelings, and we're missing a kind of a treacly part of our
Norman Rockwell.
Right. No, that's not. It's in quite concrete ways, in very specific ways, it matters for our lives that we're less well connected. Let me give just a couple of brief examples.
Sure.
Suppose you were worried about crime in your neighborhood, and you had two strategies. You could increase by 10% the number of police on the beat. Or you could increase by 10% the number of neighbors who knew one another's first name.
Well, everybody's afraid to get involved.
Well, but
the TV news stories are full of this kind of
thing. Sure, but the best evidence, the best scientific evidence shows that the second, that is, knowing your neighbor's first name, is a more effective crime-fighting strategy. Or to turn it the other way around, if we don't know our neighbors as well as our parents knew their neighbors, and that's clear, that's part of the reason why there is more crime. Different example, quality of schools. We could spend 10% more on teacher salaries, or we could have 10% more parents involved in the PTA. I'm not against spending money on teacher salaries. My wife actually is a public school teacher, and I have an economic interest in spending money on teacher salaries. But there's no question that as a strategy for improving the quality of your schools, it would be more effective to get 10% more of those parents involved in the PTA. So the fact that we're disengaging from schools and from our neighbors and from the Elks Club and even from bowling lanes means that there are real problems in our community that aren't being solved as well. So it's not nostalgia to say our communities would work better uh-huh. if we were better connected with one another.
Well, now, where are the answers going to come from, Bob Putnam? In a way, you could be talking about, well, we are talking about voluntary associations like churches. I take it that you want to be careful of injecting what the potential for political activism into the churches and taking that too far. On the one hand, you have phenomena like, the religious right. People get upset about that. On the other hand, you have the religious right looking at the liberals and say, oh, you're all secular people. You have no real sense of social values. Where is this fine line in the middle that you are looking for? Describe
well,
that.
No, I'm not actually either a religious fundamentalist or a man of the right, but I do think that the religious fundamentalists in the United States know something the rest of us have got to learn, because one of the only areas in which there's been growing engagement, growing knitting together of the social fabric is actually in the fundamentalist part of the religious political spectrum. Not all fundamentalists are right-wing politically. Mm-hmm. Many of the right-wingers politically are fundamentalist theologically. But I also think that we have to learn the habits of the heart that Tocqueville talked about, that we learn in our voluntary associations, which include habits of responsibility for one another, habits of tolerance for one another, and a willingness to be there when one another, when we need help. And the notion of this kind of stolid Gary Cooper figure who stalks off into the sunset and doesn't worry, doesn't need anybody else, that seems to me actually not an accurate or not a useful hero for contemporary American life.
Robert Putnam directs the Center for International Affairs at Harvard University. His recent piece in the Journal of Democracy was entitled Bowling Alone, America's Declining Social Capital. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with the concluding segment in a series of programs about the idea of a civil society. We turn now to the comments of Irish statesman and scholar Conor Cruise O'Brien. Among his recent books is On the Eve of the Millennium. He argues in this book that crucial Enlightenment values that underscore important Western political and cultural institutions are becoming seriously eroded. Among the warning signals is infotainment. I ask Conor Cruise O'Brien to explain.
I don't think people at any previous time in history have been so tied in to entertainment as late 20th century people, particularly young people, mm-hmm. are through the box. Because a lot of what's happening is with where both parents have to go out a lot to work and are leaving very young children behind. Uh-huh. The box is the babysitter, and these minds will be dominated by mass television.
We're moving from the political into the deeply personal, even the moral, when we speak yeah. of... this is a very old argument and a very old complaint, Connor, that mm-hmm. That people are allowing television to become a babysitter. What is it when we speak of large terms, such as understanding our culture, understanding our history? What's at stake when we speak of infotainment?
Well, I think democracy is at stake, for one thing.
This is a small word you put on the table.
Yes. Well, when we have democracy is based on the concept of the citizen, and the citizen is making reasoned choices and so on. It's always been a bit of a fairy tale,
right.
But it's never been so much of a fairy tale before as it is now.
Well, now, should I accuse you of being something of a Luddite and a sort of exercise in nostalgia here? Come on, television is part of our world.
Well, that's a reasonable hypothesis, Wayne, because I'm 77 years old, and that I would be attached to earlier parts of the century, and the going was better for me, uh-huh. is quite understandable. And I think people who are listening to me should be aware of that. Uh-huh. But I'm by no means alone, nor are these views by any means confined to my generation. I've noticed a lot of certainly young middle-aged people reacting in the same way with great alarm that, all sorts of things are in danger. Democracy is one thing, because if you look at elections now or the electoral or the process, political process between mm-hmm. elections,
right.
when people are responding to images on the screen of something they see, and Bosnia is an obvious example, which they don't understand at all, but nonetheless, they have strong emotions about what they've just seen
right.
and urge the politicians to do something. And the politicians then go out and do some damn silly thing, which they've been doing in Bosnia for a long time.
Yes, indeed.
And, I think these are degenerative changes. I think other degenerative changes are happening in the universities, particularly in the humanities and in the area of literature, less in history than literature. I refer to the bad aspect of multicultural, politically correct. Both of them have some good aspects.
And you tie this to television. You tie it to this larger concept of infotainment.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't blame. I'm saying that infotainment and this kind of stuff, the bad side of multicultural, etc. Are among a number of degenerative changes, intellectual as well as moral.
Let me ask you to pause for a moment, Connor Cruz O'Brien. Do you have, I do not mean to be impertinent, but I do want to put the question to you. Do you have answers when we speak of what you see as the threat of infotainment to our popular discourse, to the possibilities for civil society at home and abroad?
I think it's one has a certain sense of futility. I mean, we're up against big mass forces, including, for example, the information superhighway and Infonet. We know that these can be used now, not also for the exchange of pornography, and for cozy little chats among terrorist conspirators up and down the land, and nobody can do anything about it. Well, I think these are quite frightening things. One may have a certain hope that when things get a bit worse, that society will begin to take a grip on it. But, I mean, I don't give up on humanity or on the decent side of humanity. That's still there. And there are, as there's more of everything, there are probably more decent human beings behaving decently to one another on Earth at present than there were 1,000 years ago. That's almost certainly true. But there are also more and more and more of the other kind, and they seem sometimes to us to be perhaps growing faster. But above all, the blunting of distinctions, and both infotainment and pornography, for example, are about basically depriving the intellect and depriving the moral sense. And I recently got an honorary degree at Brandeis, and I was talking on those things. I talked about, for example, multicultural, that there is a sense in which multicultural is a wonderful thing, that the Jewish people, for example, throughout the world, are the multicultural people par excellence. But they're seriously multicultural. They participate in more than one culture. They act as interpreters between cultures.
This is not a trend, an educational trend that we're speaking of now.
No. The other use of multicultural really means anti-cultural. People are being taught, and taught in some of your greatest universities in this country, are being taught to despise the only culture they actually have, which is Western culture. And they have no intention of acquiring any other culture, and they are linguistically incapable of doing so. So they're cutting their own poor little cultural throats, and it's a horrible thing to see going on.
Those are very strong words, Connor Cruz O'Brien. Do we find respite or answer to this, what, in the logic of necessity, that the excess will simply go on so long and become so obvious that the pendulum will swing back the other way?
No, I think, well, as regards that branch of it, which I've talked about just now, that's to say the malign trends that are affecting certain departments in certain universities. I think a lot of people in the universities are resisting these. I think I found, for example, talking at Brandeis, that there's very great support indeed for the kind of argument I was putting forward there, and it seemed to be coming from all levels in the university. And I would like to see more of that and encourage more of that. And I know people in all the universities who are affected by this. There are also people who are struggling against it. And I want to say something on their side. That's it.
Connor Cruz O'Brien is Pro-Chancellor Emeritus of Trinity College, Dublin University. His recent book, On the Eve of the Millennium, was published last fall by the Free Press. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with the final segment in a series of programs on the idea of a civil society. Last fall, when the president sent American troops into Bosnia, speakers on both the left and the right were quick to point out that overnight solutions wouldn't come easy in that troubled part of the world. Still, as the headlines continue to tell us that ancient enmities run deep in the Balkans, often they don't tell us where these enmities come from. Ekaterina Nikova is Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Balkan Studies at the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences. I asked her to discuss the history of the Balkans and prospects there for the growth of civil societies.
The term Balkanization appeared in the late 19th century, but was coined after the Balkan Wars in 1912-1913. The problem, the big European problem called the Eastern Question, was what to do with the decaying sick man of Europe, the Ottoman Empire. And the century-long decay of the Ottoman Empire became a major issue for the balance of power in Europe. So the fights, the national liberational fights of the Christian peoples were, in a way, against the will of the Europeans, because they disturbed this concert of nation. So during the 19th century, all the stories of the uprisings, massacres in the Balkans, came to the Western press, mostly exaggerated, and they provoked this image, which was also connected with the Islamic essence of the Balkans. It's part of the Orientalism, which is so well studied. There is a kind of Balkanism similar to this externalization of the Balkans, cutting them away. And the sad truth is that today the Balkans are more backward than anywhere, any other time in history. The beginning of the century, the liberation or interwar period, the gap is growing. And something which is very typical, if there is anything continuous in the Balkans, this is the discontinuity. Unlike Western Europe, which settled down by the 10th, 11th century, and there were no major resettlements of peoples, the Balkans, as we see them even today, as we are speaking, are still solving the problems of the past. The past is well and alive in the Balkans because it was never let to die. But history should be brought in analytically, not taken for granted, not as taken as explaining everything in the Balkans. My method is to take the most spread myths and clichés about the Balkans and to put them to reality check by hard numbers, by time intervals, and by prosaic statistics. Some of these myths, like the Asian hatreds, I reject categorically. Other myths, like, for example, the myth of the eternal backwardness, I reluctantly confirm. But there are myths which I, like the bellicosity, for example, of the Balkan states, which I try to explain.
We have a paradox. We have a dilemma. On the one side, we speak of societies that are deeply proud of their ethnic roots and they have these forms of nationalism that you've been describing. How in the world do you expect a political and cultural improvement in this landscape in response to forces from outside of these countries that will make them all the same? I mean, isn't that what they have been fighting for all of these years? To be different, to be distinctive, to retain their ethnic and national identity?
Yes, but the problem is not seen as such in the Balkans at this very moment, because most of the problems of the Balkans are very urgent. Something like infrastructure, for example, that is a new great factor in the Balkan politics, in Balkan life. This is the unification of Europe.
In other words, sort of lowering the guard in order to make these structural changes.
Most of the Balkan countries have special relations, various different relations with the European Union. Uh-huh. So this attracting power of the European institutions, the success of the European unification, is a tremendously important factor in the internal development of each of the countries.
This is an incentive.
Greece is member of the European Union. Mm-hmm. Bulgaria and Romania have association agreements. And the European factor as such is, as I said, the single most important factor in the domestic and foreign developments of these countries. Because this is the only this is more than geography. This is to be part of Europe has always been an obsession for the Balkans, and this is the only time in history when all the Balkan countries are looking at the same direction: Europe. They want to become part of the European Union. They want to become part of the European institutions. They are modeling their legislation. They are modeling their customs and all this according to the European requirements.
And you think that this is enough to overcome ancient or modern enmities and hatreds? This is enough to rise above these problems that create the very dark and sinister side of Balkan politics and culture?
Not quite, but coupled with the economic progress, coupled with this sense of international stability. Because I doubt whether you can understand it, you living in a big, powerful, stable country, what it is to live in a small country, to feel threatened by your neighbors, by the great powers' intrigues. The membership in the European community gives, or the close association with the European Union, gives to the small, complex countries of the Balkans a sense of security, a sense of belonging.
Ekaterina Nikova is Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Balkan Studies at the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences. She's at work on a new book about modernization in the Balkan states, soon to be published by W.W. Norton. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with the concluding segment in a series of programs exploring the idea of a civil society. My guests this week also included Robert Putnam of Harvard University and Irish statesman Connor Cruz O'Brien. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Rockefeller Foundation, the John M. Olin Foundation, and the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, with assistance from the Inter-American Institute for Human Rights. Audio cassettes are available for $10 postpaid. Please write to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, ask for program number 799. That's $10, program number 799. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. If you want more information about the National Humanities Center, write to us or call during business hours Eastern Time. Our phone number is area code 919-549-0661. That's area code 919-549-0661. Next week on Soundings, Half the House. Writer Richard Hoffman will be here to talk about his memoir, of a boy burdened with a terrible secret. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.